Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
You can't beat the sound of a contented cat. That's why veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns developed Burns Pet Nutrition. Because he knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. And our premium cat food is designed to satisfy even the most finicky eaters. For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The angle it looked like from where we were sitting behind it, a weapon seemed to come around from the driver's door or this. Everything's happening so fast around that time, it's just, it's one thing after another. Because for any journalist, you do want to be there when things are happening, but when bullets are flying and guns are being pointed at you, it kind of changes your perspective on that a wee bit.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. 7 years ago this week, journalist Alan Sherry was sent on a news assignment that was like no other. And on an otherwise ordinary Friday, he found himself right in the middle of the Regency Hotel gun attack. Today, Alan gives myself and Niall Donald an eyewitness account of the infamous incident at the centre of the trial of Jerry the Monk Hutch. We also discuss the conviction of a member of a Cornelius Price kidnap gang for conspiracy to blackmail two businessmen and the plot which links the mob boss with the murder of Robbie Lawler. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So it is hard to believe that it's 7 years, Alan.
Yeah, time flies, I suppose, when you think about it. It does feel in some ways like yesterday, but obviously a lot's happened since then as well.
And tell me this much, because we can't, because you're on Zoom. Have you gone grey like the rest of us?
I haven't, no.
Not yet.
Oh, have I? Sorry, I have. Excuse me, yeah, no, sorry, I thought you were talking about my screen. I've definitely gone a lot grayer than I was then. Put on a few pounds as well.
I don't know.
Have to deal with that. That's middle age for you.
It is. Saw you there recently and you didn't look any different to me. But anyway.
A few drinks taken, Lifter.
So next week, Saturday, is the 5th of February, the famous day.
Mm. Yeah.
And Niall has just finished covering that, the trial, the Regency trial, where, of course, the photograph, the famous photograph, came up again and again that was taken by Ernie Leslie and run on our front page, the photograph of Flat Cap and another individual dressed in drag running from the Regency Hotel. And obviously that photograph, the story behind it being taken, is something that you'll be probably telling your grandchildren down the road. It's like, it was an extraordinary moment. Like, as journalists, we like to get up close and personal to a story. And it's great to be there when things are happening. But this was a little bit too close for comfort.
Yeah, I think so. Like you say, of course, for any journalist, you do want to be there when things are happening. But when bullets are flying and guns are being pointed at you, it kind of changes your perspective on that a wee bit.
So look, it was a Friday and we were all sort of in the office, and Fridays are busy enough for the Sunday World because obviously we publish late on Saturday night into Sunday. And Daniel Kinahan was in town. There was a boxing weigh-in out at the Regency Hotel. We'd covered loads of these boxing weigh-ins before, and there was nearly a reluctance to cover it.
I mean, like, for all the conspiracy theories that emerged in the aftermath, it was, if not an afterthought, it was certainly wasn't the focus of the morning when Alan was sent on the road with Ernie Leslie. We had got the Daniel Kinahan and some of his associates in City West, was it?
Yeah, that was maybe a year previous, and it was another boxing weigh-in.
In the South Inner City, then we'd had pictures of them and having coffee after one of the other weigh-ins. So it wasn't, it wasn't something that we were, you know.
Yeah, because I suppose to explain to people when you're getting images for a newspaper, you kind of want. Okay, you can have the posed shot of somebody posing for the camera, and obviously these, you know, gangsters and people operating in the underworld aren't going to do that for you. So what you're trying to do is get photographs of them, you know, to show them in as much as a natural environment as possible.
A bit of action.
You want them away from the courts because they're very samey pictures and they walk down the court steps or that kind of thing. You're probably more guaranteed to get them there. But so the boxing weigh-ins, it was all the same. They were all dressed in tracksuits and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, you take up, Alan, and tell us what happened when you left the office.
Yeah, well, myself and Ernie drove out to the Regency, I suppose. We got there quite early. The weigh-in wasn't due to happen until around 2:30. We'd been there for a little bit beforehand and had been... We parked at various different spots just in the car park outside the Regency and driving up by the Regency and took a few different pictures of some of the people. There was a few of the Kinahan kind of associates had gone in. We'd got a few pictures of them. David Byrne had gone in, Liam Byrne had gone in.
Did you see David Byrne, going in?
Yeah, I think Ernie should have a picture of him going in. I think that we got before, obviously, Liam Rowe, people like that. There was a few different people that we'd know and we'd recognise from the Sunday World that were there. So we were basically just there taking pictures, seeing who was there.
You weren't going to go in then? Like, it was more the point?
No, I popped in briefly. I was only in there probably for a minute or two. I know the Evening Herald were there at the same time, and Robin Schiller was in more in the room itself just before the shooting took place. But no, myself and Ernie were mostly outside, kind of circling around different positions outside just to see who's coming and going, trying to spot the different people. The easiest place to do that really was on the door because they all had to come out to generally the same door and they were mostly coming out the front entrance.
So what happened? What sort of time of day was it? It was 2:00-ish?
It was about 2:30. Well, we'd been there from beforehand and we took those pictures. So that had all happened. Just before 2:30 is when things really kicked off. By that stage, we were parked just at Seven Oaks. It's an estate in almost the grounds of the Regency. It's a kind of complex there. There's a centre, a crossroad, there's the Regency, and then a little estate. So we were facing towards the centre there. We could see people walking by past us. And at that stage, we just heard a loud bang and both turned to each other. Given what the event was, a loud bang like that obviously draws your concern. So we were about to start moving around the corner after hearing the bang when we were just seeing a load of people come flying by, running out towards the Swords Road. Some of them were on foot. There was people jumping in cars and speeding away at high speed onto mounting different paths as they were on the way. That all happened quite quickly. We came around the corner then. You're talking only a few metres around the corner, and we spotted a grey van and pulled up outside the entrance to the hotel. There was a person in the van who seemed to be armed with an assault rifle, and there were people to the right of the van kind of almost tripping over, falling over and running, trying to get into bushes, which were to the side opposite the hotel, and the weapon was being pointed at them.
So the driver of the van had the weapon?
It seemed that way, yeah, from our perspective, at some stage the driver of the van had a weapon, because from the angle it looked like from where we were sitting behind it, a weapon seemed to come around from the driver's door towards us and pointed back at us.
And was the driver, like you say, people were in bushes, the driver was kind of warning people to stay back, maybe?
Yeah, there was a gun being waved. At this stage I hadn't seen the different TAC 1, 2 and 3, so I was only aware of a gun pointing out of the van. That was all happening quite quickly. It seemed to be waving over to the right, almost warning people to stay out of the way.
So that would have been a third gun.
Yeah, I've tried to do the maths on that myself, onto who was armed and who wasn't, and whether that was someone who was inside or who was back out. But that seemed to be the driver who was armed with an assault rifle, because by that stage
we had two inside.
I hadn't seen the people inside with the assault rifle. So the first sign of that was the one coming sticking out of the van at us. And that was pointing at different people just ahead of it. It was around this time Ernie then spotted the person known as this flat cap, who we obviously know now as Kevin Murray, and then the man dressed as a lady in a wig running towards the van armed with handguns. And that's when he fired off a few inexcused upon the shots with the camera of those people and took that famous picture. At the same time he was taking that picture, the person in the van had swung the assault rifle around towards us, and I don't think Ernie had noticed it, so I shouted at him to let him know that was happening.
Had he seen Ernie, you think, with the camera at that point, or was he?
I don't think that the person, we were very close to that van. Obviously, everyone else was running away from it, so I don't know what the driver of the van thought, if he thought it might have been Gardaí coming behind him or someone from a criminal gang coming to box them in and or whatever. I don't know. I suppose they probably weren't expecting a car to come up and drive towards them. So I'd imagine they were rattled as well with the whole situation, because they see a Jeep coming up behind us. I don't know what they thought. I don't know if they had a good view of Ernie's camera at that stage. They may have or they may not. It's hard to tell what angle they had on it.
And with the press cameras, which we all know well, yeah, like it's not like a normal camera where you have to kind of hold it and press it and maybe wait a few seconds. Like they get about 20 shots a second, do they?
And they have something? A big lens, so they, you know what I mean? They aren't exactly like, you know what I mean? Even if you're looking into a car, you could see them and the lens would probably have been out the window.
But did Ernie, did he have it up for long? He just really has to hold it up for a second to get those shots.
Exactly, yeah. No, everything was happening very quickly. This isn't, you're not talking about like a long time where this was happening, where everything was happening in like at a glacial pace. This was all very instantaneous, all at the same time. In fact, like Ernie spotting flat cap and the man in the wig was the exact same time I was actually looking at the man with the assault rifle turning it on us. So both of us weren't watching either of the other things at the same time, but then became aware of them through each other, by then being having our attention drawn to it. I think I shouted around that time at Ernie to reverse, because I thought that the gunman was...
I'm sure you probably told him to effing reverse, you know.
Can I ask you there, Alan,
did you... Yeah. Like, I mean, it all happened and that's pretty traumatic and not your average day's work, but did you see the driver of the van? Was he or she covered, or could you make out anything?
No, I couldn't see, like, I know it's 7 years ago now, but from my recollection, I couldn't see much other than my initial viewpoint was a weapon coming out from my perspective, it seemed to be a weapon coming out the driver's door of the van. It was to the right of the van, pointing out initially, as I say, pointing a kind of ahead and not towards us, and then turning around and then pointing towards us.
But you see, as we've seen in the case and with the CCTV evidence and what was brought up in the defence really is, of course, that sometimes when you're looking into a car window, depending on where the sun is, depending on what's happening with the weather, the rain, sometimes you can see nothing through a car window. You know, you're just getting a glare back and you can't make out whether there's one person or anything in it. And it's just if they lean out or whatever of the car, that's the bit you see. But
this was obviously a van with no windows in the back of it as well. So, like, you're not seeing through it from behind to see what's going on in it. You're only, and because you're nearly parallel with it from behind, or not parallel, but you're behind it, so you're not getting a side on view of the window either.
You're looking into the blackness, basically.
So, how long did it take for Flat Cap and the man in drag they left the hotel door to get into the van? It was seconds, was it?
It seemed to be. Like, I can't remember exactly now. At the time, I suppose everything's happening so fast around that time. It's just it's one thing after another, because there was so much to look at between the flat cap and the man in the wig and the gunman in the van. But there was also a lot of people. You know, there were a lot of terrified people around as well. So there was big groups of people, kind of in against the wall at the Regency beyond the. Beyond the entrance. In fact, there was a group that seemed to be trying to shield someone. I didn't get a look at that stage at who they were trying to shield, but it was almost like a group had formed around someone lying down to try and stop the gunmen. Maybe they thought that person was going to be a target. I don't know who it was, still don't.
So they then, the two, they jumped into the back of the van, did you? Is that the way?
Yeah, I think so. I assume I can't even remember what way everyone got into the van. Yeah. I suppose, as I say, with the different things that was going on, there was just so much happening. But at some point, not too long after that, everyone seemed to be back in the van. And the van started making its way up then, once everyone had been back towards, there's a gated apartment complex, kind of Grace Park apartment complex there. The van drove up towards there. We slightly followed it for a while, but the gate was locked. So the van, obviously the people in the van had a key fob for it, but they pressed the key fob. But obviously, you know yourself from going up to any of these gates, they don't open very quickly. So it's kind of a strange situation where you've just had this very fast-paced shootout and then suddenly you have a van waiting, you know, what seems like eternity for this gate to open so slowly. And we'd initially kind of gone up towards it, and then I pointed out to Ernie, you know, if we're going to follow this thing, it's stuck at the gate. What do you think they're going to do? You know, will they have that time to think who are these people behind us? You know, anything could happen. So we kind of pulled back a bit then from it and let it go through. Once again, Ernie was considering following the van through the apartment complex.
Ernie,
as we were unarmed and there was only two of us, I don't think you know, his camera and my words were going to stop them. So once again, thought a bit better at that. That the van went on through, obviously, to the other side of our apartment complex, went out another gate, and then on up to another estate up in Drumcondra. I think most people would know the kind of what happened there.
And little did he know he had the picture of his career anyway in the camera.
Or did he? Did he know?
No, he did. No. He knew very quickly, because obviously, as about the pair of you would know, you can look at the back of those cameras and you can see the pictures instantaneously and have a good look at them. So no, he knew immediately after it happened what he had. it didn't take long. Like once those people had gone through the gate, and that it all happened, we'd looked at the pictures and knew exactly what he had.
But given that he thought that he had one gunman and one woman fleeing for her life, I think it was only when the photograph was pinged into the office and we put it up on the biggest production screen.
Well, I mean, it was a very, because I actually do remember you phoning me straight after and saying, you know, there were shots and we got a picture and just actually initially thinking.
Yeah, I do. I think you were the first person I called, Niall. And I think you thought I was taking the piss.
Yeah, I did because if you remember, like, we actually didn't have great expectations sending you out. It was kind of all.
Yeah.
So actually, I did think you were I thought you were just joking. Oh, we got a gunman and there were shots fired and going, well, yeah, whatever, yeah.
And then everything went crazy after that. But, I mean, it's an amazing thing to have witnessed. I'm sure, like, there's two bits there that you could probably rather at the time you weren't where you were. And at the same time, it's just one of those things that you can speak about with so much colour and real-life experience because of where you were.
Did you get that?
Yeah, but I don't think there's too many people who were there that day were, you know, would look back fondly on it at all.
No.
A lot of the people there, obviously after that gang had gone off through the gates, we stayed in the scene for a couple of hours after that. But even in the immediate aftermath, there was people bursting into tears. There was one of the boxers vomited, who'd just been at the weigh-in. Liam Rowe, who's obviously a cousin of David Byrne from Recollection, was coming out looking very upset and angry. You know, you had Sean McGovern, who'd been shot, telling guards to fuck off. Slightly hostile atmosphere towards the press, obviously, there as well. People who are associated with the Killing Cartel obviously wouldn't be big fans of the Sunday World, nor the Herald, obviously, who were there, Robin Schiller and Colin Rudin. But it was a strange, even the aftermath of it was very strange. It was the whole experience very strange.
And how quickly were the police on the scene, like how that before Gardaí arrived, like, which is also...
The first guard I saw came around, if you know that location, Niall, there was a restaurant down at the front of it. I don't know at that time what was open or not, the place always changed its hands. The first guard I noticed had come around from the front, from the Storrs Road, around that building and put a guard a cap on, like a baseball cap. That was probably only a couple of minutes after the gang had gone through the gates. I assumed there was Gardaí nearby at the time. as there would be at something like that. But obviously there wasn't a strong guard of presence.
And
Alan, you ended up, you had to give a statement, I think, in relation to it, along with other witnesses that were there on the day. And Ernie had to give evidence in two court cases. They didn't call you, no?
They did call me for the first one, for Patrick Hutch's trial. I did have to give evidence.
Is that nerve-wracking?
Yeah, it's not enjoyable going up to court in any situation, even if you're only up to give evidence as in a libel case. Well, that's actually probably worse in a way. But going to the Special Criminal Court, obviously, you know, you have a lot of people from both sides who are in that court. You've relatives of the people who are accused. You've relatives of the people who are shot. It's not an enjoyable experience and not something I'd want to repeat anytime soon.
What was your own emotional reaction? Obviously, you've written about that for many years before and subsequently, but to actually see something like that, did it change how you perceive these things, I suppose?
Yeah, I suppose. Like, I remember at the time, Mick O'Toole from the start arrived on the scene a while later. He hadn't been at the weigh-in. I think I was still a bit in shock after, because he said to me, "God, you look very white." And I was like, "What are you talking about? I feel fine, you know?" And I thought it was grand at the time. And he said, "No, Jesus, you look terrible." But I think a lot of people who were there probably like that. It kind of kicks in later, the experiences like that. There was obviously a BBC journalist that a gun pointed at him there. There was staff members at hotels, members of the public. Robin Schiller had a gun pointed at him. A lot of people there, I'd imagine, for any of them, if you ask, when you think about it days later, it's probably a bit of a post-traumatic stress or something, but, you know, it'll kick in later, like, Jesus Christ, you know. It takes your brain a while to catch up with it.
And Alan, the gunfire, that first noise you heard, is it unmistakable?
I thought so, yeah. From myself and Ernie, it was funny, I'd seen when he'd given evidence the last time, he said it took him a while to cop it was gunfire. My recollection of it is we said straight away, that's gunshots, and immediately had gone around. So I thought it was, from my recollection of it.
It's a crackling.
Yeah, it's a loud sound. I think the context of the event that was on, as well, you know, you mix that in. If you were just sitting at the shops maybe and heard that, you might think, what was that? But I think if you're at an event that the Kinahan cartel are at, and you know that there's a feud ongoing at the time, and you hear a sound like that, you know, you've a bit of a head start in your brain as to what it might be.
And of course, you know, you're talking about the trauma of it and the fear that everybody felt, but inside, and a lot of this has been forgotten, I suppose, in the coverage of the Regency and the celebrity of it and all the rest of it, in the reception was David Byrne lying dead, having been shot a number of times, and lying in a pool of blood. Now, that must have been so traumatic for anyone who saw it, and obviously for his family hearing that news. That day.
Yeah,
exactly. Obviously, and unfortunately, a lot of people obviously would have seen that, because of where that happened. It was at the reception desk, so a lot of people would have had to walk past getting out, if they hadn't already fled. Now, obviously, I know some people had got out by then, but yeah, a lot more people saw that I'm sure none of them wanted to see it.
I mean, it's amazing that the photograph, like, it's, as you said, it's 7 years this week, but again, it featured in both the prosecution's closing speech and the defence's closing speech again. It's also obviously became the central focus of the trial of Patrick Hutch Jr., which ultimately null prosecutory was entered for a number of different reasons. It's just amazing how that picture has, still 7 years later, it still was a focus for both. I mean, the closing speech, you know, in that Jonathan Dowdle said he recognised Patrick Hutch Jr. from it, and that was disputed because it was pixelated. We've gone into that again. It's just gone on and on. And people must always talk to you about it, Alan, as well. Do they still, or?
On occasion, yeah. I suppose it's one of them pictures, though, isn't it? Like, how often have you seen a picture so clear from a scene, and, you know, from a murder like that, where you have two people who are, you know, I suppose you could say they're very recognisable, are there so clearly running with guns in their hand. It's like you do see CCTV or you see maybe phone footage of different things like that, but it was just, I suppose it was the the fact it was so clear and everything else. Just...
I always thought it looked like a scene from a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I can't think of it realistically outside of war photography and something like that. I cannot think of another photograph that is equivalent.
No, and I suppose the fact that the man was dressed as a woman as well kind of added a whole new element to it, you know, like it was an attempt at a disguise, you know, added a whole dynamic to the picture, I suppose, as well.
And even the flat cap, you know, it was...
He even became known as Flat Cap, I suppose, didn't he, after that?
It just shows you, like, you never know.
It was actually constantly referred to as Flat Cap by the senior
council. Yeah,
Even in this trial, they were...
The closing and everything. But just shows you, like, every morning you get up, you have no idea where life is going to bring you or what you're going to face or, you know, that was an ordinary day that started out, like an ordinary Friday in the newsroom, and you know, whatever else, it was certainly a very memorable afternoon for all concerned. Alan, thanks a million. You're going to pop off there, and we are going to change the subject to something else. So, thanks, Emil.
Thanks, Alan.
No problem. Talk to you, folks.
Now we can take off the headphones,
okay?
Because they're really messing with my hair.
Yeah.
So, do you like my shirt?
I do. I think you look better on this side of the room. You made me sit on the other side of the room for no particular reason.
But I just thought we'd mix it up because I don't want to end up in a position where that's my chair and my name is on. But I mean, I wonder, does anybody notice that? It's just that we're on video now.
No.
Why I'm saying, do you like my shirt?
It is lovely.
So yes, fantastic. We're on video now for anybody who's listening to this on the podcast. We have launched on YouTube, which is new to us and maybe not new to the rest of the world. But anyway, we are certainly putting up one or two of these podcasts a week on the YouTube channel, which is at Crime World Podcast.
Crime World Podcast
is what it's called, yeah. And actually, the Dingle Whiskey Movie Club is up there as well, which was a live show we did a couple of months ago, which was really good fun. We gave away tickets for that, and it was an invite-only show. But it's all about basically the real-life criminals who inspired the movies. So, yeah, it's if anybody's looking for something to watch, you can go on to that. And there's other stuff besides. Now, moving on to the other story we want to talk about. There's three stories and I can only remember two, so I hope you remember the third. But anyway,
yes,
the second one is obviously the big story of the week when it comes to gangland crime. And it's this trial that's been going on in England. Cornelius Price, who was the sort of overarching leader of the Maguire faction in the Drogheda feud, very, very violent, volatile criminal who lived in a kind of a compound up at Gormanston in County Meath. He sort of joined forces with Owen Maguire, the mob boss, the wheelchair-bound mob boss, against the other side, which included Robbie Lawler and Richie Carberry and others who were murdered, some who are still alive. But anyway, he... was caught in the middle of a kidnap plot in the UK. Not long after Robbie Lawler's murder in Belfast, they were caught in the summer of 2020. Robbie Lawler was murdered in Belfast in the April. So Cornelius Price, since this, we'll go into the kidnap plot now in a minute, but since this, he's had bad luck after bad luck. I mean, the man is in a coma for months, maybe a year.
Yeah, I mean, he's been... suffered a devastating brain injury, effectively. So he has not been, he was charged with this offence. He obviously hasn't been convicted because and he hasn't been well enough to attend any court hearings. So he remains.
So did they, like, just say there was a miracle happened and he came out of that and,
Well, I mean, he'd stand trial as long as he's fit to stand trial. Medically.
As long as he's fit. So they couldn't have sort of tried him in his...
No, they wouldn't try him with an absence because you have a right to mount a defence and he is an innocent man until proven guilty, you know, so he remains an innocent man.
Such a strange story. And he's only 40.
Yeah.
Like, for somebody who went through life with such violence, he's suspected of a lot of... Yeah. a lot of very violent crimes. And I mean, it was his associates that are suspected of the disappearance of
William Owen
and
his girlfriend
Slava.
Yeah,
they were last seen at that compound up in Gormanston. His family, William Owen's family, have repeatedly begged for information as to the whereabouts, so as they can give their son a proper burial. Cornelius Price never felt enough empathy to certainly encourage anybody that was involved in it to come forward or to give them information. The graves of other family members have been attacked. It's been pretty, he's had a pretty awful life. And, you know, in a way, it's strange now that at 40 he's lying in a coma, and it's almost like, it's almost like the curse of that Drogheda feud, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly was regarded as being in the Premier League of criminals in this country, and one of the most dangerous people operating in the underworld. And I think this case shows that a kind of a different international aspect to Irish criminality. We've obviously spoken constantly now about the Kinahan cartel and the Morocco mafia and all these kind of international connections. But there is another kind of groupings in Ireland, and they have very, very deeply embedded in criminality in the UK. And I think this case shows that some of those connections where Irish criminals and criminals from the UK interchange, move around and, you know, become involved in different aspects outside of the kind of the big glamorous drug trafficking business.
Yeah. Now, this gang and this case we're talking about in the UK, the gang was headed at the time by the very well Cornelius Price before his illness struck. And it was basically two men were abducted, and it was a blackmail plot. They were threatened that they would be killed if they didn't come up with £300,000 in ransom. Five others involved in this.
Yeah, five other people were charged, and the vast majority of these charges and these people have been found not guilty. There's only one single Irishman that has been convicted in relation to this offence. Kidnapping charges were brought against a number of people, and conspiracy to blackmail and conspiracy to false imprisonment were brought.
Mm.
There's only one person, a guy called Darren McLean, who's been convicted, and he's been convicted of arguably a lesser the lesser charge, which is conspiracy to blackmail and conspiracy to falsely imprisoning. The basic story of it, again, involves this web of connections. These two people who are kidnapped, businessmen from that local area, they were kidnapped and brought to a home in Highbury near where Arsenal play football. And they told police subsequently that they thought they were to collect a debt or a debt. They were being spoken to about a debt that they owed to Warren Crossan.
Warren Crossan, since murdered, was murdered in the aftermath of Robbie Lawler's murder. Crossan is seen as his connection in the north, the son of a dissident who was also murdered.
Yeah, very. So Warren Crossan, actually, yeah, he was shot dead in 2020. The sort of general feeling is it's in a possible revenge attack for the murder of Robbie Lawler. He was suspected of setting up Robbie Lawler, who was ultimately shot dead. So these guys were brought, they were subsequently imprisoned or, you know, certainly held. And this gang of people, mostly of Irish men, threatened them with machetes. They gave evidence in court that they were told that their fingers would be chopped off. They initially believed they were speaking about a debt that was worth £7,500. But these men subsequently, according to them, were demanding up to £300,000 before they'd be released. So it was a long, very, very long trial. I think it said 40 hours of
deliberation by the jury.
Yes.
Who didn't believe, obviously, the evidence in relation to four of the men charged. They only believed and accepted the evidence in relation to this Darren McLean, a 37-year-old, in the conspiracy. So it's unusual that the victims gave evidence in the court.
Is there a suggestion
they were being protected or in witness protection?
No, I don't think it's said. I mean, it seems to have been... they didn't. Mm. Certainly from what my reading of it is. But I suppose it shows the... you know, they did speak about and gave evidence about, you know, being blindfolded, being warned they'd have their brains splattered all over the road, that they were held at a caravan site in Cambridgeshire, that they were made wash with Dettol spray, forced to call their relatives. They were put on phones to people looking to raise money. So Darren McLean, of course, didn't respond well after he was found guilty. He shouted, "This is bullshit," adding, "This court is corrupt to the backbone. The decision was wrong." Mm. And another man, one of the men cleared of two counts of conspiracy, was Quincy Bramble, who, of course, we have also heard of in a recent court case in Belfast.
Yeah, because Joe Brolly, the barrister who is representing a man who's charged in relation to the murder of Robbie Lawler, Joe Brolly has applied for bail for his client, and in applying for bail, he has put forward to the court what he believed happened when Robbie Lawler was shot dead. And what he's told the court is that this was basically a big double cross that involved members of the Dundon gang from Limerick, in particular Ger Dundon, Levi Dundon, whose father, of course, is John Dundon, who's imprisoned, and the other man being Quincy Bramble. The three of them were arrested by the PSNI in the very quick aftermath of Robbie Lawler's murder, but they were allowed to go free without charge. And in particular, Levi Killeen was freed on unconditionally, they call it. So in other words, they never want to speak to him again. The PSNI have repeatedly said, or certainly the prosecutors in the case have repeatedly said, that the PSNI are sort of still investigating this, but they don't believe that these three men had anything to do with the murder.
Yeah, certainly they were taken in the immediate aftermath, could have been charged. If there was evidence, there clearly wasn't evidence, and they were released and are not facing any criminal charges in connection. But nonetheless, they are. Their names have been spoken about.
Well, they showed up, of course, with Cornelius Price, which is the strange thing. Quincy Bramble has shown up then months later with Cornelius Price, who was one of those that celebrated the murder of Robbie Lawler.
Absolutely.
Raised a glass on social media of rum. Was and, it? Yeah, toasted it. So it's all a very complex, but it's interesting that Quincy Bramble should show up there, of course, not guilty, but nonetheless, he's within that.
And just to say, there's a guy, Danny Bridges, a loud man called Mark Cavanagh, who's from the Drogheda area originally, and Lisa Marie Finnerty. They were all cleared of two counts of conspiracy to falsely imprison and two of conspiracy to blackmail. So they are proven to be innocent in court.
Right, a really interesting case, you know, that I'm sure there was loads of evidence from that we missed because we weren't covering it ourselves. We were getting stuff into the court reporter, but...
Yeah, it shows these interconnections. It's just amazing that each of these cases and all of a sudden they're spiraling into each other, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Robbie Lawler murder is really, really intricate you know, it's something we might look at a little bit more in depth in the near future.
So I suppose at the other end of the scale, this week, probably from that kind of murky business, you have arguably the world's biggest drug trafficker.
Yeah.
A guy called Dario Antonio Usaga David, but probably better known as Otonel. Is that pronounced right?
Yeah, I'm just calling up a story because I did a really interesting interview about this guy with a journalist called Toby Muse. I'm actually going to see, will he come back on to talk about this? But he was telling me he covers Colombia, and he was telling me about him. I mean, this guy had links to the super cartels. He was supposed to have been the supplier of the sort of the Balkan groupings, which would have been where Eden Gasson and the connection for in the super cartel and to Daniel Kinahan was from. We went into, he's the leader, of course, of the Gulf Clan cartel, and he lived in the jungle and hid out in the jungle for a long time. But he was a guy, the weirdest part of it was, right, he was an ex kind of military background. Do you know, like in Colombia, a lot of the drug dealers came through
FARC. Yeah, they were paramilitary groups. Yeah.
And, you know, FARC was disbanded at one point when they said that the government was going to give the farmers, you know, new industry rather than, to try and encourage them to stop producing cocaine. They were going to give them grants to grow bananas and other things like that. And of course, it never happened. And he kind of came out of all that supposed peace deal that fell through. And so he's kind of operates this militia. Like, I mean, this is not a drug dealer, that kind of guy that is living in a big mansion and kicking back with a cigar and dripping in gold jewellery. He wears fatigues, lives in the jungle, and weirdly was into this sort of black magic.
Yeah. Well, now, it didn't ultimately save
him. Did it do anything for him?
No. I mean, one of the unusual things about it is how quickly he's pled guilty. Like, he pled guilty in New York this week to basically drug trafficking, and I think that the figure named was 107 tons of cocaine, or 97,000 kilos, and he had 216 million in cash seized off him. So it was all very quick, like, unlike say El Chapo or some of these other guys who have fought it to the bitter end, gone through very, very long court cases. He was extradited only a number of months ago, really, at this stage, and pleads guilty now almost straight away. So I think that is quite unusual.
Very.
I think as part of his extradition, he there were certain limitations to what he could face. He couldn't be ordered to face the rest of his life in jail, for example. There was some deal done with the Colombian judicial system. And of course, his arrest caused widespread chaos then in parts of Colombia, as after he was arrested, you know, the cartel basically shut down areas of, you know, attacked airports, put up barriers. So there was lots of violence. But yeah, look, it's another one of these guys who flew very high, but he's not going to enjoy his time behind bars.
So tell me this much. Are you going to get your takeaway tomorrow night?
I'm sitting over the other side of the desk now, so that's already one of my...
What number is it that you get every week, the same one at the same time?
I've moved on.
For those of you who don't know, Niall Donald has his lunch every day at, what is it, a minute past one?
No, it's actually 2 minutes past.
Sorry, 2 minutes.
I 2 minutes past one. You're not taking your normal holiday during when the Regency comes back? No, you normally take a holiday at the most important times.
Do you know what, right? But this is, I swear to God, when the date was read out in court, I went, I'm actually back from my holly bops 2 days before it.
There you go.
So my look has changed.
Yes, or our look even, as the management of the Sunday World.
Well, for that anyway, but I mean, God knows what will happen in the meantime. It's gone very quiet around Dubai and...
Yeah, yes, but sometimes it goes quiet before it gets
always
noisy.
The way, isn't it?
Yeah.
It goes deathly quiet. There isn't a kind of a whisper out of it. I mean, all I am personally hearing is that paranoia is immense. There's an absolute desire by Kinahan Senior and Daniel to find out who has been informing on them.
Yeah.
You know, and like, not to us in the media.
No.
But they cannot believe the amount about their businesses that is known.
Yeah.
And in particular, that money laundering system that has actually been taken down now from them. They're still operating to some extent, I hear. Sometimes you can't totally understand that, how, you know, but they are still operating. So they're obviously still trying to do deals. They're obviously still trying to ship drugs while the whatever's going on in the background is happening.
It's very hard, I suppose, to stop doing that stuff because there is so much operating on credit and you know, in that drugs world, like... So
well,
they have to kind of keep it flowing, like it's...
But you probably, I don't know, do you put your orders in 6 months in advance? Is it a little bit like any business?
It probably is.
They probably paid for stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you don't pay until it arrives, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They've maybe ordered stuff, maybe they have to you know, everywhere you think the book ends, there's somebody else that has to be paid.
Exactly. And I mean, if they're not delivering, a lot of it is credit. And if they're not delivering it, you know, why would people pay them if they're not going to deliver a future system? And in fact, in Rafael Imperiale, it was some of his statement has come out, and he speaks constantly about how everybody he dealt with, he was giving them credit.
Yeah.
And then collecting the money in the aftermath rather than,
yeah,
than then purchasing drugs outright from them. So it just shows you that you need that flow.
Yeah, it's a good insight into it all. But isn't it interesting that with all the troubles they have, and my God, don't they? And, you know, I'm sure they're going to bed every night wondering, is tomorrow, what is it going to bring? You know, is this the day that they're cuffed, brought in, and like everybody else, sent to wherever territory wants them? But isn't it interesting that their biggest bugbear is who broke the code?
Yeah.
Who was it that has been snitching? Who's the insider? You know, Kinahan Sr. is a highly intelligent yet paranoid individual. And he obviously, I'm sure everybody in their inner circle, I'm sure it's a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah, well, they need that code of silence in order and the fear of, they need to have people to fear of if they speak out, what'll happen, you know, so that is a part of it.
Well, I understand that there's, you know, the usual, and they've been doing this for years. They're certainly putting out pieces of information to see which way they come back or to see where they pop up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very good way of testing the waters, isn't it?
Yeah.
I give you a piece of false information. If I hear that back, I know that it's you that has spread it, you know.
Put it out. Like Colleen Rooney.
Be careful.
That's what Colleen Rooney did.
It is indeed. Yeah. Actually, yes. She's clever, yeah. Did you watch that?
I didn't watch it. No,
I did. Yeah, it's good. That's kind of all we have to talk about.
That's fine.
Over and out. We'll be back next week anyway. So
thanks, Vicola. Yeah.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Claude Amini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.